welcome to The World Today. Linda Mottram with you. This Friday, Malcolm Turnbull under attack from his own side. The Deputy Premier of New South Wales, John Barilaro, says the PM should go. Pressure on the Prime Minister too over the banking inquiry. Superannuation funds are furious they've been dragged into it. And 75-year-old former Beatle Sir Paul McCartney is back in Australia and more surprised than anyone that he's still on the road.
He may be getting on in years, but when he's on stage, Paul McCartney is as energetic as a schoolboy. If the singing voice is a little deeper, the accent is unmistakable.
It's something that's a surprise, really, because we didn't realise it was going to last this long. You know, I mean, Sgt. Pepper's is 50 years old.
Some Beatles for you a little bit later, but the National Party has been causing headaches for the Prime Minister over banking, over same-sex marriage and citizenship, and now one of their rank has lobbed a leadership hand grenade. One of the most senior Nationals in New South Wales, the state's Deputy Premier John Barilaro, says the PM should quit, and he should do it before Christmas. The new rift comes as the government struggles to sell the Banking Royal Commission it never wanted but was forced to agree to. Here's Andrew Green in Canberra.
Outside New South Wales, not many people have heard of Deputy Premier John Barilaro. Just after 7 o'clock this morning, that all changed.
Turnbull is the problem. The Prime Minister is the problem. He should step down, allow for a clean out of what the leadership looks like federally, get on with governing the country, and whoever takes the reins going forward needs to make sure that they put the country and its people first.
The New South Wales Nationals leader was appearing on Radio 2GB to speak to a fellow Malcolm Turnbull critic, Sydney Talkback host Alan Jones.
What really got my goat on Monday and on Sunday was to hear the Prime Minister of this nation turn around and say there were no federal issues that affected the state government and the state election. I mean, that's just a joke. I mean, if you're out of touch, completely out of touch like that comment, which showed clearly that the federal issues were impacting on the way state voters were voting in a state election. You know, for my mind, it just shows that there is no leadership.
So basically Turnbull should go.
Well, look, I've spent 4 days on the road, travelling through the Riverina and the south of this state, talking with ordinary people in small regional towns, and regardless of the message we were trying to sell, you know, we had some great announcements and all that, I was often confronted by individuals from all sides, from all walks of politics and the political landscape, who kept talking about the lack of leadership federally. And there is no question there is a lack of leadership.
Appearing on Melbourne radio an hour later, the Prime Minister was asked about the comments made by his state coalition colleague.
Well, you know, the last time I was with him was down at Cooma at the Snowy Mountains scheme there, and we were talking about Snowy Hydro 2. And he was full of joy with the big investment we're going to make there. And you know, he's never raised these matters with me personally. I think what's going on, Neil, is that he's on Alan Jones and he's just trying to ingratiate himself with Alan and telling him what he wants to hear. So that's what I think it's about.
Speaking to 3AW host Neil Mitchell, Malcolm Turnbull hit back.
He actually made similar comments a little while ago and I left a message with him and he didn't call me back.
Well, you want to confront him,
but he's got my number. He can call me anytime. I'd be delighted to have a chat to him. But I think it is, you know, if somebody has a view like that, you know, if I had a view about a state leader I would express it, if I expressed it at all, privately and, you know, face-to-face. I wouldn't be doing, wouldn't be bagging them in the media like that.
Must irritate you a bit.
Not really.
Really?
No.
Mr. Barilaro's comments have come the day before his federal National Party leader, Barnaby Joyce, faces a by-election forced by the recent citizenship saga. It's a point not lost on the Prime Minister.
We have a by-election. In fact, we have a National Party by-election on Saturday in New England. And so, you know, Mr. Barilaro should perhaps reflect on whether his remarks are going to be helpful for Barnaby.
Mr. Turnbull's colleagues have also been quick to rush to his defence and attack the New South Wales Deputy Premier. Deputy Liberal Leader Julie Bishop.
I couldn't disagree more. Malcolm Turnbull is dealing with the challenges that everyday Australians are facing. He has called a royal commission into the banking sector to ensure that there's stability and certainty in our banking sector, which affects every Australian who has a relationship with a bank or has superannuation funds.
But in recent days, grumblings about Malcolm Turnbull's leadership have been growing louder, particularly from disgruntled members of the Nationals. Julie Bishop insists her leader is doing a good job.
Malcolm Turnbull is leading our nation and doing a very good job.
Has anyone raised leadership concerns with you?
This is not an issue that we're focusing on.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian has declared her full and absolute support for Mr Turnbull. In a terse statement, she says her deputy has expressed a, quote, personal view which I do not share. Mr Barilaro is well aware of my position. I look forward to continuing to work with the Turnbull Coalition Government to deliver a better quality of life for the people of New South Wales. So far, the strongest condemnation of John Barilaro's comments have come from Communications Minister Mitch Fifield.
I do not have a clue what was in the head of the Deputy Premier of New South Wales. As I say, the easiest thing in politics is to get a run by whacking your own side. It requires absolutely no political skills. It's lazy, it's weak, and it lacks character.
This isn't an endorsement of Bill Shorten. It's actually the opposite. You know, Bill Shorten is the reason I'm speaking out as someone from the Liberal and National Coalition government in a senior role, to step out like I'm doing today shows how desperate my electorate is, how desperate Australians are. For me to step out like this is not an endorsement of Bill Shorten. That's actually the fear that drives me to stand up, because the other side of all this is good governments, good Liberal and National governments will be lost. I have a fantastic Premier in New South Wales, someone that I back in each and every day, that I know, given the chance, will show her legacy will be quite significant for this state. But at this rate, the baseball bats will be taken to a state government well before the federal election.
New South Wales Deputy Premier John Barilaro ending Andrew Green's report. Well, Federal Cabinet Minister and interim National Party leader Nigel Scullion has dismissed Mr Barilaro's leadership comments and says the comments are ill-mannered and unhelpful. And Senator Scullion has asked John Barilaro to give him a call. He's speaking here to reporters in Sydney.
Well, I'd have to agree with Barnaby that, look, I often look at motive. I have no understanding why John should ring Alan Jones and have a chat about the Prime Minister whom he didn't ring earlier. You know, that's just manners. So you're going to have a big red-hot crack at the Prime Minister. You're going to throw him on the unemployment queue. You're also going to need a reason. I didn't hear one of those. So, look, John, you've got my number, mate. Give me a ring. I'm not sure what's ailing you. But if you need a bit of therapeutic download with Nigel, you should have a yarn to me too. But I'm more than happy to get you in to see the PM if you've got some problems. You know, his door is always open to everyone. He's that sort of leader. So if you want to have a yarn, I'll make sure I'll set it up for you. What we've got to do in the media, we've got to sort of start a bit more foreplay. You know, you start back a bit softer. The first question, I stub his toe, should he resign? Like, you know, these are people who've got kids at school, they've got, you know, wives that currently love them or husbands that sort of... You know, these are real people with real jobs. And ask him to tear their job away is just not a good start. Like, John Barilaro is an absolute cracker bloke. I've door knocked for him in Queanbeyan, and I know him well. And he's a wonderful bloke. That's why I'm a bit miffed by this. But look, you know, people have bad hair days. I suspect this is one of them.
Indigenous Affairs Minister and Country Liberal Party Senator Nigel Scullion at a news conference in Sydney this morning. Well, behind the politics, a major feature of the Banking Royal Commission announced in a backflip by the Prime Minister yesterday is that the terms of reference have been widened to include the superannuation sector. That has angered supergroups who have not been hit by the scandals that have plagued the major banks. Peter Ryan is the Walkley Award-winning senior business correspondent for the ABC, and he joins me in the studio. Peter, congratulations.
Excellent.
Why is the superannuation sector so unhappy, given that the main focus will be on the big banks?
Well, Linda, there are concerns that by being forced into a royal commission, the government's taking a glass-half-full attitude. Supergroups say it's an opportunity for them to push through reforms to the governance of superannuation boards. The government's plan is to ensure that super boards comprise a third of independent trustees plus an independent chair, rather than the current 50-50 makeup between management and union-backed employees. Industry Super Australia Chairman Peter Collins told me earlier today that this is an ideological pursuit by the government, having been forced into a corner. I also spoke to Martin Fay, Chief Executive of ASFA, which is the peak policy and lobbying group for the super industry, and he says that by targeting super, it's just a waste of time and money when the government should really be focusing on bigger economic and social issues.
We've had numerous inquiries into superannuation over the last 10 to 15 years. There's currently 5 bills before Parliament, so we're very disappointed that the industry is going to be diverted for the best part of 15 months away from looking after retirement outcomes for individuals.
You're unhappy that superannuation is part of the widened brief for the Royal Commission, but isn't that fair enough? Are you certain that there are no ticking time bombs within superannuation?
Superannuation is prudentially regulated by APRA, and what we know is that APRA has a very strong approach to regulation. Our superannuation system, Peter, is ranked number 3 in the world. If our education system was not ranked number 3 in the world, it would be just behind Finland and Singapore, and we'd be having street parties. The system's incredibly sustainable, and there's no evidence of systemic shortcoming. So this is another review which is going to detract, and we know that political pragmatism has resulted in this, but we really feel that we'd be better off focusing on delivering good retirement outcomes for members.
Are you concerned that there's an element of guilt by association if you're being lumped in there with the big banks, which a Royal Commission was originally going to focus on?
I think when we look at the terms of reference as they've been released, and they'll become fixed pretty soon, it talks about meeting community standards and expectations and acting in members' interests. Now, acting in members' interests is something that the industry does already. Community standards and expectations is a strange construct. You know, I hate to think the things that have been done in the past, Peter, in the name of community standards and expectations. Some of the worst atrocities that we've experienced as societies have been done under that rubric. So I think, you know, we're going to have to be very careful about how we interpret this. You know, social license would have sent Copernicus to the stake.
Do you have any concerns about the way international investors might view this, given, as you say, the superannuation sector is strong, reliable and unaffected by scandals?
We very much do. If you look across the globe, you know, Australia was incredibly lucky. You know, we escaped the worst ravages of the GFC. And around the world, countries have struggled to recover. Taxpayers have borne an enormous burden. But here, the fiscal impact on the public purse was very, very minimal. Our banks all came through. And I think we really have to be careful that we don't undo, in the interest of political pragmatism, that we don't undo what is a really good system.
Given the wide draft terms of reference, are you concerned that this Royal Commission might turn into something like a David Murray financial system inquiry?
The concern I have is that we are going to spend the next 15 months as a superannuation industry going over areas that have been examined by other inquiries to the detriment of better retirement outcomes.
Do you feel, though, that there's a level of retribution in including superannuation in the Royal Commission?
I can't speak for what goes on in the minds of politicians and the political machinations that happen in Canberra. And I think the big issues for Australians, will I have enough to live on in retirement? Will I have to sell my house? Can I afford aged care? Who will look after me? And I think there are some really pressing questions for retirees that we should be focused on. And unfortunately, I think this is going to be a distraction.
Martin Fay from the Peak Super Lobby Group, ASFA, speaking to Peter Ryan. Peter's with me in the studio. Just changing tack a bit, Pete, some big news from Telstra with a downgrade in its earnings. What's caused that?
Well, Linda, this is all to do with ongoing problems with the national broadband network. Earlier this week, the NBN Co said its sales using hybrid fibre coaxial technology along with Foxtel cable would be delayed for 6 to 9 months. Now, Telstra had based its projected earnings on the NBN's corporate plan, and that's now having to be revised. So Telstra's pre-tax earnings forecast for the next year is down by $600 million from a top-end forecast of $11.2 billion. Telstra Chief Executive Andy Penn thinks this will probably be a one-off, that things will eventually get better, he hopes. But he told me the NBN is a critical nation-building technology, even more important these days given increasingly high expectations for NBN speeds.
I think what I would say is that with technology innovation, you know, increasing, the importance of connectivity has elevated both in terms of businesses and for individuals and consumers. All sorts of technologies are going to be important in supporting that. Mobile technology And critically, the NBN is part of that overall equation. So if all of our interests are completely aligned to a successful rollout for all Australians. It's obviously a very big project. We're not doing the rollout, obviously. It's an NBN government initiative and program, and it wouldn't be fair for me to sort of comment qualitatively on it. We're just here to support the NBN in any way we can in making sure the rollout is effective and they hit their plans as they can. And I think, you know, the right decision's been made here because there's clearly were some negative impacts on customers, and it's important that the rate and the pace of the rollout is not pursued at the expense of getting the best possible experience for customers, and we'll continue to advocate for that point.
Telstra Chief Executive Andrew Penn speaking to analysts and journalists this morning, including our own Peter Ryan, who's rushed back to the studio for us. Pete, given that bad news, how did shareholders react?
Well, the biggest news, Linda, is that Telstra is maintaining its 22-cent dividend, having been hit with an investor backlash in August when the dividend was cut. Telstra shares were down less than 0.5% to $3.41 in late morning trade, and that's a pretty modest reaction given those NBN-related problems.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. Peter Ryan, the ABC's senior business correspondent. There have been calls for an inquiry into why former security workers from the Manus Island Detention Centre are having their insurance claims rejected. A former security guard has spoken to the ABC about his struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder after his application for compensation was dismissed. David Chen reports.
It's a daily routine for Rick Morse, taking a handful of pills to treat the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The former Wilson security worker was diagnosed with a mental illness after leaving the Manus Island Detention Centre. The 54-year-old says he developed PTSD after receiving threats on social media from asylum seekers at the facility.
I was getting harassed and threatened. My wife was being threatened. And that incident ended up bringing me off the island when I got a little bit sick. They were making threats towards my family, yeah, that they'll get my family, they'll get me. When you're on your Manus Island and you've been there a while, the refugees are quite freely spoken.
After arriving back in Australia, Rick Morse sought treatment and also made an insurance claim to cover his costs. Auckland Securities insurer, Southern Cross Assurance Limited, based in Port Moresby, rejected his application. It said his mental illness was a pre-existing condition and that he'd failed to disclose it. Rick Morse again.
Because I've had PTSD before, they classed it as a pre-existing injury. Like I'm ex-military, I'm ex-copper. So I have had mental issues in the past. Haven't had any treatment for 5 years, no medication for 5 years, no treatment, no referrals, no nothing for 5 years. And then I had the incident, which then caused me to relapse. When I saw my actual psychiatrist, he said, no, it's not a relapse. It is a new injury. It has all been caused by the incident over there. It's just like breaking your leg. You break your leg once, it heals. You break your leg again, you've got another injury. So, and that's what he said. So that's why they claim that it's been denied.
A former colleague who only wants to be known as Tim says Rick Morse has been poorly treated.
Well, the insurance they had wasn't suffice to cover what could end up happening. Trying to talk to Wilson's and garner some support from hierarchy was always hard, especially when you're looking at something like a PTSD claim or, anything like that. They pretty much just shut the door on you. So it's very difficult to communicate with Wilson's about any issues that you do have.
Tim wants the company to provide better support to its former employees.
Well, just be treated with respect and fairly, obviously. Talk to them would be the first thing and see what their issues are and then try and work together to reach an agreement or something that helps everyone move forward, whether that's retraining and or employment for them back in Australia. I mean, all the people I worked with over there were fantastic guys. They were wonderful security guards and they did take pride in their work. And they're exemplary humans. They're all great people. So they need to be looked after.
Tim is a former colleague of Rick Morse. That report by David Chen. And Wilson Security was contacted for this story but referred the ABC to the Immigration Department. The department says it has strict clauses requiring subcontractors to have the appropriate insurance. Deliver it within 100 days or it's free. That was the promise of tech billionaire Elon Musk when he pledged to build a giant battery for South Australia to help provide stability to the grid and prevent load shedding blackouts. Well, he has achieved delivery. The world's largest lithium-ion battery near Jamestown in the state's mid-north has just been officially launched. Our reporter Caroline Winter is there. Caroline, can you describe this giant battery? What does it actually look like?
Linda, we've heard so much about this giant battery. It's actually, funnily enough, coming over the hill into the Hornsdale Wind Farm, it's actually dwarfed by the 99 wind turbines that surround it. I'd say it's probably around 100 metres squared in size, all white Tesla power packs, which I'm sure people have seen pictures of those. And it sits sort of squarely in the middle, just on its lonesome, really. I'm in the middle of effectively farming land where these turbines are. And the skies are grey. Mother Nature has been oh so kind for the last couple of hours. It was almost that the launch of this momentous battery was not going to happen here today, but it has. And Premier Jay Weatherill has been on site here, along with Romain Desereau from Neoen, who is the French owner of the wind farm. Now, Elon Musk, the man at the centre of it all, of course, the billionaire businessman who effectively made this battery happen, he didn't make an appearance, despite a helicopter flying over at one point, and all heads did turn, thinking that perhaps he was going to make an appearance.
And so this is the official, was it all sort of cutting of ribbons and so forth this morning?
It was fairly low-key, the unveiling of a plaque. There was no big red button to push or a ribbon being cut. So a fairly low-key event. Actually, the battery itself, this is the official day for launch, being the 1st of December and obviously the first day of summer. But the Tesla battery actually began dispatching stored wind power into the electricity grid yesterday, a day ahead of its scheduled switch-on. So it actually put out 70 megawatts of power, and that was quietly tweeted by AEMO late yesterday afternoon. So it obviously is up and running and working well.
We're going to find out a bit more in a moment about what exactly happened yesterday because it was a pretty important test moment, but stay with us for that. Just remind us why the battery was built, Caroline.
Yeah, look, I think there was probably, there's been a lot of publicity around Elon Musk for obvious reasons, and he did come into the fray, but it was only after the statewide blackout in South Australia last September, which I'm sure everyone will remember well, certainly South Australians do. And that was followed by load shedding in February as Adelaide then sweltered through a heatwave. And so after that in March came the South Australian government's $550 million energy plan, which they launched really in a bid to try and stave off this happening to South Australia again. And in that plan, there were promises of a state-owned gas-fired power plant and in it, building Australia's largest battery. And that was sent out to tender to the highest bidder, all aimed at shoring up the state's energy supply and ensuring, as Jay Weatherill has said previously and time again, that South Australia could then go it alone and be self-reliant on the energy front. But we'll all remember that the tweet that came that really, I guess, almost goaded Elon Musk into giving this a go when it was suggested that could he do it? And he took on this this great challenge, I suppose, to see if he could build it within 100 days. Now, he's done that in, as I understand it, at 63, an agreement was signed at the end of September to build this and or to guarantee that it could supply the energy to the state and to the grid. And here on the 1st of December, we find ourselves with it built. Now, we know that South Australia has been, a political football when it comes to energy. No endless barbs thrown by the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and, of course, Josh Frydenberg, the Energy Minister. And today, again, Jay Weatherill, the Premier, reiterated that this really shows that South Australia has come to the fore and has managed to, in some ways, go it alone and provide this battery along with the rest of its plan as we head into summer.
Okay, Caroline Winter, thank you very much. Well, the renewables enthusiasts say that the battery signifies the shift from the 20th century power system to the 21st century. But what does it mean in practical terms for South Australian energy users? Well, Giles Parkinson is the editor of the website Renew Energy, and he says the battery already came to the rescue during the peak in South Australia yesterday, as Caroline Winter just mentioned. I spoke to Giles Parkinson earlier.
A lot of people describe this as, oh, 100 megawatts, 129 megawatt hours, all that's going to do is power 30,000 houses for an hour or so, and then that'll be it. But that's not exactly its purpose. It's going to do two things. One, there's a part of the battery that's actually contracted to the South Australian government that will help out in the case of major faults. So if a line goes down or there's tremors in the network, then the battery can actually respond really quickly, faster than any gas generator, faster than any coal or diesel generator, and provide the stability and security to the grid while other slow-moving machines can then respond. The second thing that it will do is what we actually saw happen last night. Yesterday in South Australia, it was really hot. The wind died off. There was a huge amount of peak demand with the air conditioners, and there wasn't so much a shortage of supply, but it was getting low. So what happened was that the Australian Energy Market Operator asked the Tesla people to do their trials, which they're going to do during the day, and do it in the peak period. So at one particular point in the evening peak at around 4:30 and 5 o'clock, it put in 70 megawatts of power from the battery, and that helped meet the peak demand without having to switch on another gas generator. It meant that less fossil fuels were burnt. It meant that actually prices came down because rather than switching on a really expensive gas generator, you had a battery there instead. And then it basically disappeared. And what it put into the grid at that moment was what it had stored from the neighbouring wind farm the night before. So I think everyone was pretty happy about the way that happened.
The battery idea came about because of the load shedding blackouts that hit South Australia and New South Wales. Is there a guarantee that this battery can stop that happening again?
Well, it can certainly hope, and what it does mean is actually a smarter, cheaper and cleaner way of actually addressing those issues. So if you think about the way that we've responded to these things in the past, and load shedding has actually happened in Australia over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's not actually that uncommon. But what this means is that we've actually got a smarter and cheaper and quicker response. And what we'll see over time, as more and more batteries are installed throughout the grid, we're going to see greater stability. For instance, in a few months' time, you're going to see another big battery installed also in South Australia at the bottom of the York Peninsula. That's at the end of the grid. It's also next to a wind farm. What that will be able to do is provide or create a microgrid. So if there's power outages elsewhere, then that will actually be able to keep power on in that area using the output from the local wind farm and the local rooftop solar and providing like a mini grid for those people to continue operating. And we'll see a whole bunch of different applications across the network, because the exciting thing about batteries is it does more than one, two or three things. You know, it can walk and talk at the same time and do much, much more. And it can actually be used to defer the amount of money you need to spend on new poles and wires or upgrading transformers and things like that. So once all the market rules are properly aligned and actually recognize the value of this storage, then you're going to see more and more put into the grid without the need for government support or direct subsidies.
And you described that situation last night in South Australia where the battery, you know, did that job brilliantly. But once that battery has been run down, it's been run down. There's nothing left in it. So if you have an ongoing scenario, as you often do in South Australia, of, you know, successive days of hot weather, successive days of really high use of air conditioners and electricity demand, the battery's not going to be much use over time, is it?
Oh, yes, it will, because most of the time, even though you get those four days of hot weather, you don't have those critical peaks running for 4 days. It usually just comes at one particular point of the day, and that's where that battery can be very, very useful. The market operator has a whole bunch of different things that's available to it. For instance, in Victoria yesterday, a grid that relies heavily on coal-fired generation, one of the very big units from Loy Yang A was not available because it tripped about a month ago and hasn't come back online. So it was also a hot day there. It was also running out of supply. So what it did was implement something under their sort of emergency rules, and it contracted for something called load management, which is basically, well, we don't actually know what it was in this case, but presumably it was a major manufacturer or a major user that volunteered to reduce capacity or their demand or their load at that particular point in time and got paid for it. So it's not something that's required of them or sort of imposed on them. It's part of a voluntary measure. So rather than just trying to switch things on all the time, you can actually source different sources of technologies to actually reduce the load rather than increasing capacity. And it's just a smarter and cheaper way of doing things.
So it's around better management as well as building up the amount of storage that we have available.
Oh, absolutely. Look, if you think about the prices that we pay for electricity right now, it's because every time we have a problem, we thought we could solve the answer by building more and more. So we've built these huge networks. We've built this massive fleet of generators, most of which are used for only a few hours a year, and yet we're paying the cost of all that construction. So if we can actually find better ways of actually managing that grid, instead of just building something new every time we think we're going to have a shortage, we actually have more batteries, or we have more load management technologies, or other smarter means of dealing with that, then that's actually going to mean lower prices over the longer term.
It all sounds fabulous. What are the risks and what are the unknowns that we need to be looking out for?
Look, there's still risks and there's still unknowns. With the rollout of the battery storage, I mean, there's a few things to be taken into account. One is having a proper strategy for the rollout. Two, I guess, over longer term is making sure that these batteries can be recycled. But if we actually encourage more to come out, then I think we're going to see a big reduction in costs over the shorter term and over longer term. And we'll also start seeing other forms of storage too, particularly pumped hydro.
Giles Parkinson, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Giles Parkinson, the editor of the website Renew Energy. This is The World Today on ABC Radio and Radio Australia and streaming live on our website and via the ABC Listen app. On Facebook and on Twitter, you can find us at ABC News. Still to come on the program, Sir Paul McCartney is in Australia and at 75, more surprised than anyone that he is still touring. We'll hear from him and, yes, there'll be some music. A new front has opened up in Chinese cyber espionage against Australia, with Australian law firms the latest target, a cybersecurity expert says. Widening attacks that are known to have occurred against law firms in other countries, the hackers are seeking out sensitive commercial information. A research body is also thought to have been hacked, with stolen information likely to be passed on to Chinese companies. In a moment, we'll ask what the Australian government is doing to face down China over these threats. But first, this report from Connie Aegis.
It's an espionage group based in China, but capable of hacking computers around the world. The group is known as APT-19, and it has its sights set on companies in Australia. Tim Wellsmore is the head of threat intelligence at a private security firm called FireEye.
We know that that group has been heavily targeting law firms. Their activities are in support of Chinese state interests, but at this stage we haven't been able to attribute them to actually serving members of the Chinese government. But we do know that they conduct their operations directly in support of Chinese mission.
The group has allegedly been targeting law firms and a research body in Australia. Tim Wellsmore says that could be because the confidential information can be used by Chinese companies ahead of business negotiations, mergers and acquisitions. He says Australian law firms are starting to wake up to the fact they need to protect themselves.
We're also seeing a lot of law firms in the Australian region starting to realise that they're sitting on information that is extremely valuable to other nations, and there's a lot of focus in protecting that information.
It's not the first time APT-19 have hacked companies. Fergus Hansen is the head of the International Cyber Policy Centre at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute.
At this stage, they've been attributed to a number of significant hacks. One of the big ones was the attack on Anthem Healthcare, which occurred in 2015 and resulted in the stealing of 78 million health records of individuals. So they're a sophisticated group with pretty high level of capability. It's often difficult to understand exactly what the motivations are for specific hacks, but I think law firms, for example, are vectors into all the most important parts of the economy. Being able to infiltrate law firms gives you access into, you know, what might be happening in, say, mergers and acquisitions, issues that companies are dealing with.
Fergus Hansen says there are many computer hacking groups based around the world, but it's the ones in China that are proving to be the biggest threat to Australia.
China absolutely is the single greatest threat actor to Australia when it comes to hacking groups. So I think that explains why there's such a big focus on China. And it's a mix of both state backed organisations and groups and some freelancers that either operate independently of the Chinese government or with some degree of sponsorship from the Chinese government.
And a major issue in fighting the threat is that hackers know there is a low risk of being identified and prosecuted.
Every country around the world is really up against this problem of how do we push back and start to shift the needle away from essentially making cybercrime a risk-free activity where there's almost no chance of being caught. If you look at the number of incidents reported last year for Australia, there were zero prosecutions. Essentially, there's a whole range of difficulties. First is tracking the hack back to its source and identifying who actually committed the act. That can be very time-consuming and resource-intensive. Then if the person is actually based overseas, you have to engage your law enforcement to engage with another country's law enforcement, and there may be a reluctance for them to participate and cooperate in that activity. And then you actually have to go through a legal process in a foreign country, potentially, if they do cooperate.
A spokesperson at the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet has advised organisations to review the protections in place to best secure their data.
Connie Agius reporting. Well, the latest Chinese hacking revelation comes on top of Labor Senator Sam Dastyari's demotion for tipping off a Chinese Communist Party-linked businessman and donor that his phone was bugged. So is Australia doing enough to defend Australia's interests against threats from China? Ian Hall is Professor of International Relations at Griffith University.
I think probably not as robust as some of us might want. I think the reality is that for a good 20 years or so, all Western governments, and that includes Australia, have taken the approach that economic engagement is the best way to deal with China and to allow China to economically develop in the hope and in the expectation that we would see political liberalisation and that we would see some sort of tempering of Australia of Chinese foreign policy as a consequence of that. Australia has damped down criticism. It's been very careful about things that might upset or anger Beijing. We haven't seen a meeting, for example, between the Dalai Lama and an Australian Prime Minister for some time now because of concerns about how that might play out in the bilateral relationship and the kinds of punishments that might be inflicted by China on Australia as a consequence of things like that. So, in fact, that's the approach that we've taken. The question has to be asked, you know, has that approach worked and is it serving our interests? And I think that's where things become a little bit more murky, because I think the evidence is now stacking up that approach is allowing China to influence Australian politics in ways that we perhaps don't want.
For example, in the Sam Dastyari matter this week and previously.
That's right. So, I mean, what we've seen over the last few years is a pattern of not just things like cyber espionage and intrusion into commercial systems and so on, but also attempts to try and influence the political system and to influence individual politicians and more broadly to try and influence the Australian public, parts of the Chinese diaspora, people of Chinese origin who live in Australia as well. And they've done that in a number of different ways. One of which is simply through political donations and through conventional lobbying and through getting close to individual politicians, people like Senator Dastyari.
And so what's the alternative? I mean, if we look, for example, at the foreign policy white paper the government released last week, it spoke of strengthening Australia's ties with countries, like-minded democracies, countries like India and China. Is that a valid way forward?
I think so. I think there's a number of different things that need to be done. I think, and so I think some things are in fact being done as well. Look, domestically, there has to be some change. We need to have much more control and regulation and scrutiny of things like donations and things like practices of lobbying, which includes registering political lobbyists and indeed, you know, creating systems to punish people if they engage in lobbying outside the conventional system. Then on the kind of foreign policy side of things, there's no question that Australia has already been working with kind of like-minded countries across the region to try to coordinate policies, to try and coordinate approaches, to try and build capacity, to try and share intelligence and information and assessments about what is going on in China and about China's behaviour in the region, and to some degree also to try and build kind of military capabilities and intelligence capabilities to, if things went wrong, to try and manage problems that might arise from China.
Does the region trust Australia to take a leadership role in this way, though?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I think there's no doubt that over the last 10 years or so, there's been a little bit of uncertainty about Australia's approach, quite rightly, because of Australia's very considerable economic interests with China. The government has tried to some degree to have it both ways. But the result is that if you sit on the fence, of course, you know, others in the region wonder a little bit about which side you're going to fall when push comes to shove.
So there's still work there to do. Going back to China then, you say that there's no sign that the convergence idea that you talked about earlier is really working. But on the other hand, take the cyber realm. The statistics on Chinese arrests of cyber criminals runs to tens of thousands a year. Is that maybe a sign that there is a sense in China that they have to moderate some of their activities?
I'm not sure. I think there's a spectrum of activities going on there. So on the one hand, you've got people running scams on the internet. That might involve stealing things, but it might also involve running betting cartels and these kinds of things. And there we've seen a government crackdown to try and stop some of this activity going on, because it doesn't just harm people outside China, it's also harming people within China as well. But what we're also talking about here are kind of government-linked or sponsored or arm's-length activities that are being carried on to hoover up information from defence companies or from legal companies, to hoover up commercial secrets and so on. Now, all states do that to some degree, but what's being done on a scale with China that is really, I think, unprecedented.
Ian Hall, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Ian Hall from Griffith University, and his article called Australia's Search for a China Policy is in the online magazine of the Institute of Asia and Pacific Studies. Labor has again called on the Federal Employment Minister, Michaelia Cash, to stand aside after she refused to answer questions at a Senate committee. The issue is who leaked information in October about police raids on two trade union officers. Senator Cash says she cannot give answers because there's a continuing federal police investigation into the circumstances around a media tip-off to the raids on the Australian Workers' Union. The minister's senior media advisor admitted to the leak and resigned, but in a new twist, it's emerged that Australian Workers' Union investigators have been unable to locate that staffer, David Degaris, to serve a federal court subpoena. Peter Lloyd reports.
It was a hearing convened to continue the grilling of Michaelia Cash over the leaking of information about raids on two union officers. Labor still has much it wants to know, but today the senator said she can't give them the answers they're looking for.
Obviously, neither I nor the officers at the table will be answering questions that could prejudice investigations carried out by these agencies.
Michaelia Cash is citing a legal doctrine that a minister may seek immunity from requests and disclosures if the documents in question or the answers would be prejudicial to the public interest. Labor's Doug Cameron wasn't happy, and his statement in response to the immunity claim triggered an uproar.
If the minister is under criminal investigation, the minister should immediately stand down.
Thank you, Chair. I will address that immediately. Senator Cameron, you can make whatever accusations you like today. May I make it very, very clear that I am not, I have never been not, under any form of investigation.
It was back in October when Senator Cash repeatedly denied to the committee that her office was behind the leaking to the media of a federal police raid on the AWU in Sydney and Melbourne.
I'm advised that this information came from a media source. I was not aware of it at the time and was not aware of it earlier today in estimates. This took place without my knowledge and was not authorised by me. As previously indicated, I was not notified of the raids until I watched them unfold on the television. My staff member has resigned.
So, Minister, why did you not ask the questions you asked during the dinner break any time between the first denial that you made and your fifth denial?
As I have stated, my staff member came to me during the break after I had sought further assurances and he admitted to the course of conduct that I have outlined.
The warrants had been sought by the Registered Organisations Commission to ensure documents weren't tampered with. The commission is investigating $200,000 in donations made by the AWU, including $100,000 given to activist group GetUp in 2005, while Labor leader Bill Shorten was the union secretary. Today, the minister confirmed that she hasn't referred any other matter to the Registered Organisations Commission other than the one involving AWU donations when Bill Shorten ran the union. But that was today's only revelation, as Labour's Doug Cameron soon found.
Minister, are you now able to advise how long Mr. De Garis worked in your office?
Chair, in relation to that particular question, it would be subject to the public interest immunity claim.
Senator
Cameron...
Public interest immunity, how long someone has worked in your office? Are you serious, Minister?
Yes, I am, Senator Cameron. It is up to me to judge which matters may or may not be subject to the AFP investigation.
So the length of time someone worked in your office is now subject to public interest immunity?
Senator Cameron, I believe I took that question
Senator
Cash says she'll provide answers to that question and others that have been on notice when the hearing resumes in 10 days.
Peter Lloyd reporting. Almost 1,400 buildings in Victoria have been identified as likely to have some form of flammable cladding. An audit by the Victorian Cladding Task Force has found at least 8 hospitals, as well as high-rise apartments and government buildings, have combustible cladding similar to that which caused London's deadly Grenfell Tower inferno earlier this year. The state government is reassuring the public that the buildings are safe and that steps are being made to rectify the issue. But one building expert says they're not doing enough. From Melbourne, Claire Slattery reports.
Victoria's Planning Minister Richard Wynne says the issue of non-compliant cladding is more complicated and more widespread than first thought.
The Task Force interim report paints a picture of a culture of non-compliance throughout the building industry, and frankly, everyone needs to lift their game. This is a systemic failure of the industry as a whole. It's decades of non-compliance and a culture of cutting corners, and we have to fix it.
In an interim report released this morning, the Victorian Cladding Task Force has found hundreds of buildings across the state are likely to have the combustible material.
The task force has identified that there are 1,369 buildings that are likely to have aluminium composite panels with a polyethylene core or expanded polystyrene, and they will be treated as a priority.
The cladding is similar to that which caused the 2014 La Crosse apartment fire in Melbourne's Docklands, as well as London's Grenfell Tower blaze that killed 80 people. Often imported illegally from China, it's been found to have been commonly used in buildings across Australia. But Richard Wynne is keen not to cause alarm.
I want to make it clear, though, that these buildings have been declared safe to occupy. And I repeat, all of those buildings have been declared safe to occupy, provided certain safety measures are met, such as sprinklers, alarms, and obviously internal management by the body corporates.
The task force has made a raft of recommendations to fix the situation. They include physical inspection of all 1,400 buildings in the next 6 to 12 months to see if rectification works need to be done. Thus far, only 100 buildings have been looked at, and the Victorian Building Authority will allocate $5 million to the task. Use of the aluminium cladding in the future will be restricted to buildings below 2 stories. The government will also require the VBA to increase the number of building inspections it carries out a year from 2 to 10%. Former Deputy Premier John Thwaites co-chaired the task force.
Clearly, our findings are that we need to boost the level of enforcement and compliance activity by the VBA. The building industry needs to understand that they're going to be audited, that they're going to be checked, and therefore they're going to do the right thing. And that's why the Minister has indicated that there'll be a substantial boost in the amount of auditing work undertaken by the authority.
But the National President of the Builders Collective of Australia, Phil Dwyer, says the recommendations fall short of what's been introduced by other states to address the cladding issue.
It
bothers me that we haven't done anything about the cladding issue, as well as many other issues in the building industry, which they've also highlighted. Whereas states like Queensland have already moved and removed cladding from buildings and so on, and brought in legislation that makes it illegal to use this product and so on.
Phil Dwyer says Victoria first knew about the risks with the La Crosse apartment fire in 2014 and should have done more by now.
We're looking at November 2014, and the whole matter has languished for that period of time and continues to languish today. And that's what bothers us, that if there was another accident and there was another fire, we may not be so lucky the next time. And, you know, certainly the Grenfell fire in London highlights the need for a little bit of urgency here, which we don't seem to be applying.
Phil Dwyer from the Builders Collective of Australia. Claire Slattery, our reporter. Paul McCartney is about to begin a rare Australian tour, the 75-year-old's first tour down under in more than 20 years. He'll kick off in Perth, and our reporter David Webber has learned that Sir Paul is amazed his career has lasted this long.
He may be getting on in years, but when he's on stage, Paul McCartney is as energetic as a schoolboy. If the singing voice is a little deeper, the accent is unmistakable.
It's a kind of magical thing, you know, because when you write a song, you've got nothing and you suddenly produce like a rabbit from a hat, you know. And it feels really good. And you get a bit addicted to that feeling. And then you perform it with an audience and you get addicted to that too.
Sir Paul held court at the Regal Theatre in Subiaco, where fans were invited to ask questions before a few journalists were allowed to sneak a few in. He suggested he didn't suspect he'd still be in demand in the 1970s, let alone when he was in his 70s.
It's something that's a surprise, really, because we didn't realise it was going to last this long. You know, I mean, Sergeant Pepper's is 50 years old this year. And, I mean, you know, we had no idea that it was going to last even more than 10 years.
Sir Paul spoke of his memory of arriving to the massive crowd in Adelaide in 1964. He talked about the first dog he owned, Martha, and gave a little advice to a 9-year-old who said he wanted to change the world. He found himself reflecting on the wide range of ages in his audiences.
It's a great feeling, and I've seen some lovely things at shows. I remember one in Brazil where there was a dad, obviously a tall guy with a beard, and he's got this beautiful young girl with him, and she's looking up at him, I'm doing Let It Be, and he's looking down on her. It was a real sort of beautiful family moment, and it's a choker, because I've got to sing this thing and not cry.
For this road veteran, the experience of touring has definitely changed for the better since those heady days of Beatlemania.
It got a bit much, because in the end we couldn't really hear what we were doing, and that's one of the big differences now. We can go louder than the audience now. I'm older, the audience is older, we've got dads and sons, dads and daughters, all people of different ages in the family. That's very different. It really was pretty much just screaming girls.
Paul McCartney has promised to deliver career highlights because he believes that's what the audience wants. He said the idea is based on his own experiences of spending hard-earned pocket money on disappointing shows.
If I was going to our show, what would I want to see them do? And that's the start of the list. And then we go through it and we put in some songs that we would like to do that people might not necessarily know. But it's basically to please the audience. And I'm not ashamed to say that, because they pay good money to come to the show.
After Perth, Sir Paul McCartney plays in Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney and will be in New Zealand by the middle of the month.
Sir Paul McCartney and band, Junior's Farm, not a hint of irony. David Webber reporting from Perth. That is The World Today for this week. I'm Linda Mottram. Executive producer this week, Kim Landers. Associate producer, Barney Porter. Research by Flint Duxfield. Technical production, Alan Arthur and Jane Stacey. Digital production by Laura Briley-Newton. And web publishing by Jacqueline Boof and Sandra Orr-Prince. Eleanor Hall will be back with you on Monday. Thank you for your company. Have a great weekend. Here's a little bit more Beatles for you to take you there. That's it.